I'm a pastor, as you may have heard, in New Ulm, Minnesota, and eager to walk with you this week in the book of Exodus. It's a text that I've become very fond of and am eager to encourage the stirring of your imagination, my imagination, our imagination together. Just a word about kind of perspective or approach here. I think it's a parish pastor's privilege to walk that intersection between a text and people's lives. That's to say, I'm very confident that you can find Bible studies that are more academic, more academically credible, though I hope what I offer is academically credible. And you can find experts in humanity, be they anthropologists or psychologists or historians, that are more credible about what people are like. But it's a parish pastor's privilege, it's my privilege as a pastor, to get to walk the place of that intersection, where a text meets people's lives, and where people's lives meet the text. It seems to me that that is the vocation I feel called to, or at least I'll make a claim to, this week. That's to say, I have no lesser hope than that we'll make new discoveries about the text, and no greater hope than that the text will stir new discoveries about us. One thing for us to be able to say, we know the book, okay? We know the story. Another thing when we can say, the story knows us. It knows the world in which we live, and it gives us promise and power with which to face that world. One, and it's never more fun than when the text just stands up and surprises us. When it's like, we thought we knew this text, and then we can't believe that the text knows about this too. I've got a great story to tell you. It doesn't come out of the book of Exodus, so I'm gonna just tack this on at the beginning. But I think it's a great story to illustrate how it works. With my confirmants last year, I was reading the book of Joshua. And one of my students was reading. She was a very bright student, good reader, not at all intimidated to read before the class aloud. So she's reading along, and then she gets to the word, and she's going, and I said, prostitute. Oh, she said. I said, do you know what that is? Well, yes, she said, but I didn't expect it here. Isn't it amazing to discover the places of the world the text knows about? And then what happens to our imagination, what happens to our living, when we let the text guide, these are steps, rather than our limited imagination, or our culture, or whatever other power, okay? So, I don't really have this set up to be presentation discussion. I hope it will be an integrated discussion. As you have comments, discoveries, I can't know where this intersects your lives, or where you have questions about discoveries, but I want you to know you're welcome to share those anytime. Just raise your hand and jump in. And my hope is that I'll have some new discoveries myself. So we start with Exodus 1, chapter 1. I'm going to read from the Revised Standard Version because I went through seminary with this Oxford Bible and I've got my notes in it. Amen. I will make my my own translation for inclusive language where that's necessary. If you're using another translation and it offers something, don't hesitate to share them. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the offspring of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the descendants of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. I want to stop there and just talk about that verse for a second. I mean, the historical interpretation would be simply to say there's a new dynasty begun in Egypt, probably the 19th dynasty. But I'm convinced that there is a great deal more going on in this little verse than just change of political power. I love to suggest tongue-in-cheek that the text is aware that sometimes life is changed by politicians who don't know. Many of you ever suspected that? Maybe some of you suspected it's changed by pastors who don't know too. Yeah, something like that. I said the text stands up and surprises us. I've said we're going to read the book of Exodus, and then the text stands up and says, no, read the book of Genesis first, and I hope you will. It says, here arises a king who does not know the history, does not know Joseph, doesn't remember that time when Joseph and his insight into dreams spared Egypt a famine, and the years of prosperity in Egypt spared Israel a famine. Doesn't know that marvelous history. I think in light of the theme of Holden this summer, it's important to pause here because we could easily read this book and assume that Egyptians are strangers, or at least pharaohs are strangers, okay? But the text already stops us to say, no, wait a minute. There's more to the story of that. The pharaoh doesn't know that. The pharaoh doesn't remember that. But don't you be like those people who don't know Joseph and who don't know that history. I'm going to pause here because I think the text affirms the way life has these curves, you know, these curves where all of a sudden things change. It's gone well for the Israelites in Egypt. They've prospered. The land is full of them, and 70 persons, the fullness of persons, seven stands for the fullness. They've prospered, but all of a sudden here comes a twist in the road, and things are going to be very different. Not least, we pause at this verse because that marvelous story of Joseph, if I say enough about this, I hope I'll persuade you to reread it tonight, the last half of the book of Genesis, now immortalized by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Donny Osmond. Did any of the rest of you see Donny Osmond be Joseph? Wonderful musical portrayal of the story. I just loved it because it followed the Genesis story so closely down to the end, when Joseph flies with this amazing technicolor coat behind him and they're singing about Joseph and the story, and it ends. Everybody claps and it's over, and I wanted to scream. How can you stop here? Genesis ends, Genesis 50, the end of the story, with Joseph saying to those brothers who sold him off into slavery and who now tremble on their knees in tears in front of him, and the book of Genesis ends, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. The Pharaoh doesn't know that story. The Pharaoh has forgotten that tremendous witness. But as we enter into what is on some levels a really awful story, a curve into oppression, let us not forget Joseph, who stood before those brothers and said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Any comments, any reactions about what we're going to remember from Joseph, what the Pharaoh doesn't remember from Joseph?
I just like to make a personal comment. That verse has meant a great deal to me because I read it as God uses evil for good, not that he means evil, and it has sustained me in many difficult parts of my life.
Mm-hmm. The Genesis 50 verse.
Yes.
Yeah. God uses evil Marvelous segue into the rest of the chapter, because we're going to find out that power is a huge question in the book of Exodus. Who's got power? And what is power like? And what kind of power does evil have? How does it use that power? And how does God respond to that power? These are all questions we get to play with as we move through the story. Any other comment? Go ahead.
Isn't that partly what the text means when it says he doesn't remember Joseph? He doesn't remember that power exists. He doesn't remember that God works through these Israelite people.
Yeah.
So he's not remembering the spiritual side too.
Well, there are all kinds of implications of what he doesn't remember, or he doesn't remember what it was like when the Pharaoh was willing to share his power. Can you imagine a Pharaoh? Pharaoh considered God in Egypt, a totalitarian leader who is willing to share power with this foreigner who is an interpreter of dreams. Clinton is not a totalitarian leader, but how would we respond if suddenly he allowed an Arab who was an interpreter of dreams into his cabinet? We know how the press responded when we found out Nancy Reagan read horoscopes and then told Ronald about them. You know, people were just... It is that radical kind of sharing of power. Doesn't remember the power of God, first of all, but also doesn't remember the kind of power involved in sharing power. So what does the Pharaoh do? What happens when this Pharaoh forgets? Or what happens to people who forget their history? And that's another piece of this question.
Well, what's the time frame between when all of these brothers die and the new king arising?
I don't know. 400 and some years. The total number of years is 450 years. But the whole question of how numbers function in the Old Testament is a question, you know. Is the 70 persons a head count, or is that a poetic statement of fullness? Is the 450 years a chronology, or is that an indeterminate, like, you see what I mean? But it's a long time.
But I think
they've been generations.
It's important also to see that he said he didn't, not that he didn't remember about Joseph, he didn't know about Joseph.
Yeah, ignorance.
So you can kind of play that back in our own history of the United States. So, I mean, it can't be too critical of this guy not knowing about him, because he may never have been taught about him either.
Right. Well, and you see, the other thing that will be contrasted here by tomorrow is what God does know. To know is a very important verb in the book of in the Old Testament, but especially in the book of Exodus. Our theme tomorrow, today is kind of the situation. Tomorrow will be, how does God respond to this situation? And by Wednesday, we'll be into how the people respond to God's response. Okay? That's sort of where we're going. At least it's where I think we're going. We'll see. The other thing that, I mean, I suspect that many of you actually have read this story before, is that the Pharaoh is not the only ignorant or forgetful person in the story, which is why it's so important that we don't conclude too soon that the Egyptians are the strangers. I mean, by Thursday, we'll not only have the Israelites delivered, we'll have them forgetting their deliverance. So, I mean, what goes around comes around. And we'll spin these questions from all different sides. The Pharaoh said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war befall us, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Rameses." Okay, I hear the text separating out power words. I've said power is a big question. The first word I hear is threat. Do you hear that? The Pharaoh is threatened by these people. That's kind of an interesting situation, because Pharaoh's got, or at least appears to have, absolute power. I mean, slaves are generally not terribly threatening people, but he's threatened. He says, let's deal shrewdly with them. So he sets taskmasters over them that I hear control. Okay? Let's do something about this. Control is another power word. And before we get much further, that control is going to be sheer, unadulterated force. Now, the reason I like the way the text separates this out is a lot of times we hear people jumping in right here. Let's do something about this. Why doesn't somebody do something about this? Things are out of control, okay? Or worse yet, they just start here. This is it, and I've had it. And now we're going, you see? And so what the text can invite us to do is, we hear somebody who's convinced that force is the only option. To look behind it, what is in need of control, or even behind that, what is the threat? It said, I don't know where this will intersect for some of you, but in the groups in my parish with whom I read this last year, there were a number of parents who said, you know, power is a, sometimes a parenting question, sometimes. And you know, parents would say, you know, it seems like the more I try to force my kids, I didn't know what Jane Stroll was going to do next door, next hour. I'm going to go listen. Listen for power words, for power questions, because children are very powerful. And how do we respond to that power? How do we live with that power? Questions about threat, power, control, insights, discoveries. Well, the first question I have is, how well does it work, Mr. Farrell? How's it going, this force? I mean, it's been a marvelous gift for counseling when somebody comes in and says, I've had it with this and now I'm going to change it. Okay. I'm going to change that person with whom I work. Okay? I'm going to change the person with whom I live. Fine. Tell me next week how well it works. I mean, don't we live with power questions? A lot. Let's listen in now. We've got a Pharaoh. We've heard him threatened. We've watched him assert some control. Now let's see what the text does. Resolves this very quickly. Verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. You suppose the Pharaoh was swearing? I know. Curses. This is not working. And the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they made the people of Israel serve with rigor and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. And in all their work, they made them serve with rigor. I'm really convinced if you want to know what a text is about, pay attention to what's repeated. I mean, isn't that an interesting couple of sentences? They made them serve with rigor, hard service. Hard service in all kinds of work. Do you get it? Have you heard it yet? Or are you paying attention to it? That sign is so marvelous for what we don't get and what we don't pay attention to. The repetition is right here. And we see this becoming oppression. And moreover, already we see it becoming counterproductive. Isn't that interesting? What happens with the power of evil? How do we respond to it? Is evil capable even of destroying itself? Go ahead.
Instead of rigor, my translation uses the word ruthless.
Ruthless.
That kind of cuts deep.
It sure does.
Little more familiar word.
In Bible camp in Minnesota in the summer, 90 degrees and humidity, I love to make kids stand in the sun, you know, and go like this, telling them about when we were in Israel and it was 110 degrees in the shade And water was $1 a bottle. Okay? And imagining what it would be like to make bricks in the mud, ruthless, hard service for the building of these cities that remain to this day. It quickly becomes a pretty awful kind of story where threat and control and force, power goes.
May I go back a little bit?
Sure.
Why did he feel threatened? What were they doing that he felt threatened? Was he really threatened, or was it only his interpretation?
Wonderful question. Why do any of us feel threatened?
The only thing it says is about numbers. The only reference it makes to the threat is there are too many of them. He's getting nervous that there'd be too many and overtake the... They never...
He was afraid they would leave. Maybe that's
what
happened with our children.
Yeah.
Isn't that why we feel threatened?
Change. Okay, change.
Well, did it say they were afraid they were going to rise up against them and join up with the enemies?
But what I'm hearing the question here is that a fact? I mean, is that a factual possibility, or is that just something he imagines? Threat is an interesting kind of power, isn't it? Is it real or is it perceived? Yeah. And we see one of the other things that I think so good about this description of the situation is the Pharaoh's response starts out defensive. He is defending. But you see how quickly it becomes aggression. See, and a defense never feels aggressive. It's defending. I mean, listen to the way the buildup of armaments in our country was talked about. We must defend. Is this defense or is this aggression? And I listened, a former parish loved to tell former parish stories. I lived through a worship war where, having started contemporary worship, then people from more traditional worship responded, and then the contemporary worshipers defended, and how interesting that defense and aggression became indiscernible. Everybody was defending. None of us is being aggressive. We don't mean to say anything bad about anybody else. Bing, bing, bing! You know? I mean, Pharaoh isn't hurting anybody. He's just doing what he needs to do to protect his power, right? Maybe we never have less power than when we're protecting. Is that interesting? I think so.
I was thinking in the United States in 1942, early on, you know, on the West Coast, the Japanese were rounded up. Understandably, from the point of fear, because we were attacked, you know. But interestingly enough, it was a lot easier to round up even second and third generation Japanese Americans than it was to round up German Americans, who were infinitely more in number, actually. There were some pressures. I know, you know, they closed up some German American societies, but not near the, price paid, but it was a threatened action that caused all these people to be deported to god-awful places.
If you've not read Snow Falling on Cedars, it is a must read. It's just marvelous, the experience of Japanese Americans in World War II. Now, the power of fear. Fear isn't, the Pharaoh was afraid. I used the word threat, but I think fear. The other thing that's so marvelous here, I mean, I always like to get ahead, what does every angel ever say from God?
Fear not.
Fear not. Okay, Ruth, did you want
to? Well, I was going to liken our history repeating itself with Hitler and the threat from these same people.
Mm-hmm. Name a threat. That's right. Find a threat. Feel threatened. And there too, we're the Aryan race defending itself from the Jews, and how powerfully aggressive that became.
And also right now, I mean, the Aryan race is going to be outnumbered at some point in the not too distant future, and people are afraid.
Oh, yeah.
And so history is repeating itself again. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it's going to end, but the fears are out there.
Yeah. And do we respond out of fear, or do we find some other source of response? Go ahead.
Well, I think maybe another word you can put up ahead of threat is insecurity.
Okay.
You look at all these leaders, or all, you know, all the things we're talking about, that it seems to me that that's really the source of what makes them feel the threat, and then the other steps of control and force.
Yeah.
And the same is true from the workplace, where a boss who's imposing things, it's his insecurities that lead to that threat, that leads to his control and forcing people to do things that aren't so pleasant.
Well, I want to respond to your question one other way. I mean, the question about is it perceived or is it real? That's an interesting distinction to work with, but I also think it's important to allow the text to speak to real threats. That there may be a sense in which we would say insecurity is a perception, a perceived threat, but there are times we know that threats are real. The Pharaoh will make that very clear, that threats are real. So one of the other questions we can bring to the text is, how do we respond to real threats? Can we do that now? The next chapter, or the next paragraph, get us into that. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. Okay? I don't even know what word we would add beyond force. This is beyond force. This has now become genocide. We're going to control this population. But I entitled this session, The Power of Irony and the Irony of Power, because Pharaoh here makes a funny move. He kills the male children. If you want to control a population, let me just put it this way. Anybody who grew up in South Dakota, I grew up in South Dakota, knows that whether you're talking about a population of cows or sheep or chickens or humans, you only need one male. Although I had a parish in my first parish whose rooster had a broken leg. That created some problems. It was great. My first parish, the whole first year, every conversation was about breeding. Finally, one of our friends got pregnant, and she said, enough breeding. I said, well, good. I didn't know anything about breeding, but I learned a lot. It even applies to Bible study. You know, that isn't it ironic that how misguided force became, maybe we can say becomes, but at the very least became, to kill all the male children. Well, we got Shifra and Puah. We've got some new characters, and I love them. If it is a daughter, she shall live, okay? But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife comes to them. Isn't that a great line?
Egyptian women are really...
Yeah. Well, I mean, the obvious question is it true? I don't know, but you are no exception. Every group I've ever read this verse in front of laughs. I dream of the day that even in worship we read the text and go, what a hoot. This is a non-response. It doesn't matter if those children are 10 minutes or 2 hours old. they can still be murdered. I mean, this is no kind of response.
In the same room 9 years ago, I think we were here last, somebody of an Afro-American viewpoint shared the same text, and he said, shucking and jiving is born in Israel. In other words, the women were lying to the Pharaoh, but they were doing it for a noble cause, and that's why the black community identifies so well with the book of Exodus. A lot of things were said to Masta in his mansion that were lies, but they were said for a greater cause, so someone might be able to escape and have freedom, you know. And there's a lot of parallels, and it was a fascinating comparison of these two oppressed peoples and how they draw their strength, you know, from this this story.
See, I keep changing my mind about what the book of Exodus is about. I've already said I think it's about power. I think it's a lot about power. It's about freedom. It's very much about freedom. And the more I work with the book the whole way through, the more convinced I am that Shifra and Pua are the freest people in the whole book. We're going to watch the children of Israel walk through the Red Sea. You know that. You've at least seen the movie. And yet, the children of Israel will struggle to be as free as Shifra and Pua. And what does the text say already about the source of their freedom?
Fear
of God. For those of us who memorize the catechism and have since tried to teach it, we are to fear and love God. Why fear God? Well, here we can say maybe that's the only word strong enough to hold you up in the presence of a Pharaoh. The love of God, we'd like to think the love of God does. But when somebody is asking you to murder, the fear of God that is in them and so gives them the courage to disobey. Sue doesn't know I'm going to say this. At the time we were having our kids, I was into exilic literature. So I threatened to name a boy, if we had one, Nebuchadnezzar. And that's why my confirmants think I got three girls. Could be. I had so much fun trying to think of themes for naming the girls. Parts of the liturgy, Gloria Patri, Agnes Dei. Wouldn't it be fun? She can be glad I wasn't into Exodus at that point, or we'd have had Shifra and Pua.
Her daughter should especially be glad.
Whether it would have stirred in them the fear of God, I know not. They'd have ended up spelling their names a lot.
Egyptian or Hebrew?
Hebrew.
They were Hebrew.
They were Hebrew. They were Hebrew midwives. But Nebuchadnezzar was a Babylonian. That was more radical. Somebody said, well, I'll read this first. Verse 20. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Somebody at 7:45 said, you know, what's more amazing than that the midwives said it is that the Pharaoh took it from them. And not only took it from them, but then speaks the next chapter. You cast the male children into the Nile. Good English teachers say, here is foreshadowing. A male child is going to be cast into the Nile. Is going to be drawn out of the Nile, and you know, the Pharaoh doesn't even know it. The irony of power. The irony is that literary tool where a truth turns on itself and becomes the opposite of what it appears to be. It appears that the Pharaoh has all this power, all this control. Here he's going to go. He's going to make this happen. And he describes what's good. He says it. You cast the baby into the Nile, and it's, of course, going to be more deeply ironic, his own daughter, is going to help undo. Okay? So one of the questions that stirs us for tomorrow is God's capacity to pay attention to these curves and twists and long, slow stories. We're a long ways from getting this resolved. A long ways. How does God respond to that? God's capacity for using the least likely characters. I'd like you, if you have a chance sometime between today and tomorrow, read chapters 2 through 4. We'll just be able to read segments together, but if you get a chance to read the whole thing, that can help stir your questions in our discussion. And one of the things I'd like you to do, to focus on, is to really try to get Charlton Heston out of your mind, okay? So that you can let the text create the Moses we pay attention to. One of my friends teaches at Augustana in Sioux Falls, and he proposes that Moses should have been cast by Don Knotts. That he would be more faithful to the text. Now, what happens to Moses? Cecil B. DeMille is entitled to his own interpretation. I don't mean to diminish that. I just want to say it's not the only interpretation of Moses. And so let's not let... Because you see, the thing that happens is we think we know the story, and so then we find what we think we know. And we're back to the old perception question again. And we don't... So that we get ourselves to the place that we can't imagine that there's a prostitute in the story, even when the word is right there in front of us. Yeah, we can't even imagine that. And so read that, listen for God's response, for the ironies as they go deeper in the next couple of chapters. The last question that I wanted to discuss out of this chapter, we actually may have time to go a little into that for tomorrow, but the last question I wanted to discuss is when it says, so God dealt with the midwives and the people multiplied and grew very strong. Is what is it about the creative power of adversity? What is it about that? It's a question that I find myself going back to again and again and again. Whether the shape of it is, why is learning so painful? Especially learning the things I thought I already knew, like fearing God is the beginning of wisdom, or as the true power. What is it about that? I think that this situation wants to push us to some edges, not that we need to create. Those edges are just out there. If they're not in us, they are in our neighbors. And the text is saying, pay attention. Pay attention to those edges, and out of them comes learning, comes growth, change, freedom, transformation, all of these things. It's kind of interesting to just stop at the end of the first chapter and stew them, because we've got both cross and resurrection so close, and the oppression is more awful than we can imagine. And getting worse, the force keeps pushing, and real power keeps emerging. It won't be stopped. And when you start paying attention to that, you just see it all over the place. So Mount St. Helens erupts, and there are all these catastrophic predictions about where life will never be. And in a matter of years, there are fish in the lake again. And nobody knows where they came from. How do we already get fish in the lake? Yellowstone burns. And I cut a headline out of a newspaper and put it in my redemption file that says, "Life from death in Yellowstone Park. Forest only lives if it burns." And then, what about people? You know, what happens to people when they become truthful about the effect of false power? And then even in the midst of it, are given characters who are freed from it. You know, I think about a Martin Luther King who stood not only in the presence of white racism, but stood in the presence of rebelling blacks to speak pacifism and to say to both sides, if you have to throw stones, throw them at me. That's pacifism. That knows that there's power in stones, but that seeks other sources of power. Well, that started out to be a question. Ended up being a sermon. I feel like I should apologize. What do you make of that power? And let that word, where does that stir your imagination? Your discovery.
One thing from the African-American experience is I talked to people who said that they really shouldn't exist. They've been abused and their families have been destroyed for so many generations that they see that their existence is a testament to God's power. And here, too, the only reason that they didn't get wiped out, or at least all their baby boys get wiped out, is because of God's existence. And so they credit, you can credit. You can see God's action most clearly in adversity.
Yeah.
When there is no logical reason that you would survive, and you do, and you can see that it was because of God that you survived, you can see it so much more clearly.
Yeah.
And when you're not under an adverse situation, you think maybe you did something good.
The same friend who would cast Moses by Don Knotts is a Jew, and would say the same thing about Judaism.
Right. Most oppressed people do.
It should not exist. I mean, it has been tried again and again and again to destroy it. And we have a chapter of that in our own century. I think the chapter for me that's most powerful is the destruction of the temple under Nebuchadnezzar. When we were in Israel, you go back to the Wailing Wall, the western wall of the temple, the only piece of the temple that was allowed to exist. And when you go to the model of Jerusalem, it shows you what piece that is and how minuscule it is in the whole scheme of the temple. And one day a year, the Jews were allowed to come back to the Wailing Wall to pray. The oppressors assumed it would defeat them, it would remind them of their defeat. And it strengthened them. It renewed them. And here, of course, is a theology of the cross. We do not move away from death. The cross moves us toward death. To say that it is absolutely real, unavoidable, and that in the death of one, all of us gain the power to live by facing that death. Any other questions or comments? Go ahead, way in the back.
Continuing with these ironies here too, and with what you were just saying, these people, these Israelite people, who should have been the least powerful, had the most powerful, and among those were these two women, mm-hmm. who were not powerful even in the Israelite society.
No.
And yet, they were the most powerful.
By their own admission, not even needed to do their jobs. Didn't need them. Go ahead, Nancy.
Along those lines, too, with the bringing the babies, I mean, the fear wasn't so dumb in terms of killing the male children, because except for in understanding how God created us, in that the whole culture didn't understand reproduction, because the woman's womb was just the receptacle, all the creative power about life was all in semen, So he thought he was doing the job by killing the male children. So it was even more ironic. You know, I mean, he knew way less than even the text thought he didn't know. I'm not sure that was English, but you get the point.
You end up with triple and quadruple negatives.
Not that they're going, oh, wow.
That's because, Nancy, conservative Egyptian religionists wouldn't allow sex education in the public schools.
The Hebrew is much better than Hebrew.
No. Well, it is study in power. And how the stronger defensiveness gets, the less it sees itself as aggressive and the more aggressive it becomes. And a culture that wants to oppress sexuality, not deal with sexuality, ends up preoccupied with sexuality. Every commercial, every movie, absolute total preoccupation. So the trick becomes, how do you even talk? You know, because you've got these two extremes. One that says, oh, I can't believe you said that word. And the other that says, well, nobody will go to this movie unless you show it playing out in front. What is going on? Except gross misunderstanding of power, which may be more conversational. And Martin Luther has a great quote. He says, when things appear to be opposites, tie their tails together like raging dogs and let them chase each other in a circle. Isn't that a great image? Because opposites end up being exactly like each other. And neither is true. That somehow, you know, the poetry here keeps stirring our imagination to say, no, that's not it. And no, that's not it. And, well, Shifra and Pua have got it, but I find it really hard to believe, you know, that would be it. Amazing. Go ahead.
But with all of this power coming from Pharaoh, the two midwives show the thing that's important. Midwifery standing beside the caring, the supporting.
Yeah.
You know, and they do with that kind of behavior what he has no ability to do.
Mm-hmm. This has become a joke in our family because I like to say the most important word I learned in seminary was You know, it does not appear to be a terribly powerful word, but when somebody is saying something really stupid and obnoxious and just begging you, daring you to be stupid and obnoxious back, it's a wonderful word. You just say, you know, but how many of us would dare say it, short of the fear of God, to a Pharaoh who's got, you know, who demonstrates that he doesn't hesitate to murder? And, but, you know, oppressed people garner that power because they've got so little to lose. See, they've got the other thing that happens. I mean, where does threat come from? Threat comes from having things to protect, having something to lose. I was at the ALC assembly, one of the times, churchwide assembly, one of the years that divestment of South African funds during apartheid was discussed. Minneapolis? The Minneapolis?
Oh, no.
It was discussed at many of them for years. And to hear South African blacks, I mean, the argument against divestment is that it would have hurt the blacks worse than it hurt the whites. So, I mean, challenging argument. You've got to take that seriously. And then these blacks from South Africa stand on the floor and say, please, do it to us. We're on the bottom rung of the ladder. It won't, you know, it won't hurt much to fall from here.
I mean, the tremendous power and the willingness to fall. Do you start to hear echoes of a verse that says, whoever would save their lives, lose them? And those who lose their lives, save them?
So by being stupid enough.
We've still got 10 minutes. Let's go on to chapter 2. The question they said is, how does God respond? Okay? Now a man from the house of Levi went and took to wife a daughter of Levi. If this is definitive of God's response, is there anyone here who would like to say, so what? You've got Pharaoh oppressing a whole race of people, killing all the baby boys, and here you go, talking about romance? One man marrying another? I mean, that's not particularly original, is it? What I hear the text doing that I think is a biblical theme is moving to particularity. Okay? I think we expect God to, you know, to do something cataclysmic, something global, something universal, some sort of announcement. The part of the Christmas story that makes sense to us is angels singing in the sky, okay? If God were going to do something, God would send angels and they would sing in the sky and everybody would hear it and then it would all be okay, right? I mean, that makes sense to us until we find out that the angels sing to shepherds. And then Luther again is just brilliant when he says the least one of those angels could have done is go help Mary. Luther's Christmas sermon is just rich for catching the edges of a God who acts not only in particular, but peculiar ways. And that's here. In our parish, we read Exodus last year. This year we're going to read Matthew, because Matthew's the gospel that offers Jesus as a new Moses. And the parallels are striking between the books. So I mean, that could be a fun thing for you to do when you go home too. You just read it and then go back and recall the way Jesus is offered by Matthew as the new Moses. So the first thing that happens is that the text doesn't give us a ruler more powerful than Pharaoh, doesn't give us the United Nations, doesn't even give us angels in the sky. It gives us a man from the house of Levi who gets married. One of the interesting things, one of the questions I'm eager for us to pose in any Bible study is, who are we? Well, we don't want to be Pharaoh. And I have a hunch, at least I'll own this, I would be scared to death to be Shifra or Pua. But a man marrying a woman, well, gee, I've done that myself. You know, I can be this person. I can do this. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Well, I'm not sure I could do that. And this is one of those places where the fact-value split, you know, is this factual? Can you really hide a baby for 3 months? We had 3 of them. For the life of me, I would not have wanted to try hiding. And they were good babies. None of them were colicky or anything. They were just babies, but they were eminently not hideable. So I, you know, that one's a mystery. When I take Exodus in heaven, maybe then I'll figure out how that worked. When she could hide him no longer, it starts to make sense to me. Okay? She took for him a basket made of bulrushes, daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's bank. Do any of you feel tears welling behind your eyes? To imagine hiding your child from the oppressor who wants to murder him, and now in the hopes of his own life, casts him into the river, but in a basket.
Isn't that basket kind of like an ark?
The comparison has been made. Mm-hmm. Or like baptism. Yeah. The theme, the water theme, is rich through the scripture. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked among the river and saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and lo, the babe was crying. Okay. She saw it. That's a simple kind of thing. But one of the things that my friend, another theme of my friend, who's the Jew from whom I've learned a great deal, is to beg to be seen. To be seen as human. Talks about what happens when people cease to see the other, the stranger, as humans. Be that Pharaoh and Jew, Nazi and Jew, white and black, male and female. What happens when you don't see? When you don't see a child, see a human. I mean, there's a moment of mercy here, a great turn in the story. She sees him as a child, and there's hope here for a breakthrough. Maybe more hope than all the angels in the sky who ever sang to persuade us to see a child. She took pity on him and said, pity could also be translated compassion, to feel with, come and pati, pity and compassion come from the same word. This is one of the Hebrew children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. Wow. She not only gets to keep her baby, she gets paid for it by the very Pharaoh who wants to kill him. Isn't that ironic? Now the irony gets reversed in Matthew. When Herod wants to kill the baby boys because he's heard from the Magi that a new king is born, in Egypt, they flee to Egypt. Did you just hear the irony? When Egypt is safer for the Messiah than Israel? Ooh. We talk about the dividing wall of hostility dropping. The power of walls, of locks, is they not only bind people out, they bind people in. Our culture hasn't figured that out yet. We keep building fences, security systems.
Amen.
And so we are, you know, we're locking out strangers and hoping against hope that our house doesn't burn because we could never get all these locks unlocked in time to get out. Who are we binding? Who's in prison here? And what happens? You know, what happens? Well, nothing happens until a stranger gets in, and probably it'll be a child. Meaning the story, it's a child, and the child gets in, and even his mother gets in. And he started paying her to nurse her own baby. Now, let's draw a map. Okay? We got feral, threatened, controlled, forcing, killing male children. Okay? The Pharaoh's got a daughter who brings one of these children into her home. Do you hear irony and the power? Who's got power? Who's got power? Moses probably has more power right now than he'll have the rest of the book. Certainly more than when he tries to lead his own people. Certainly more power than them. And Moses has got tremendous amount of power right now. So the woman took her child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, for she said, because I drew him out of the water. Another literary sign, okay? But what the first thing I want us to hear about God's response is... is that God doesn't respond by pulling the whole people out. God responds by pulling one person out. We have all kinds of peacemaking discussions that deal in so many generalizations about how many curricula we should write, laws we should pass, and workshops we should hold. And meanwhile, neglect their own fences and locks and insecurities and threats and fears, and God who says, fear only me. One of the most challenging things I ever learned, I mean, so much so that I don't think I've quite learned it yet. It's one of those sentences that keeps working on you. It took an ethics workshop at Iowa, University of Iowa, from George Farrell, who said, those who refuse to fear God condemn themselves to the fear of everything else.